With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Jokes with Mark Simmons, the podcast where I chat to another comedian about jokes they can't get to work. As always, in the Jokes podcast studio, I am joined by the one and only Mr. Comedian Danny Ward.
Hello, everyone.
Here he is.
It's in the outdoor studio tonight, Mark.
We are in the outdoor studio, yeah. Little balcony.
We could be in Spain here.
It's lovely, isn't it?
If it was 97, had a bottle of vodka sitting there, a couple of litres of cola, anything could be happening. But as it is, I am going home to a chicken and leek. M&S ready meal.
Are you? You have ready meals. I haven't had a ready meal for a long time.
Does the Pope have a balcony, Mark?
You ever hear my ready meal joke?
Yeah, go on.
Just got to try and remember it. I got a microwave meal the other day, but the packaging was really rude. It said, "Do not remove film lid prick." It's a good joke.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah, yeah.
It? Solid.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard that.
Yeah, in the past.
Could you get it to work or?
It's a mixed. It doesn't always work.
Because it does.
It always gets something.
What it is it's do not remove film lid, comma prick. I mean, we work on the assumption that's what it says.
Do you think I need to leave more of a gap?
Perhaps. And also,
do not remove film lid, prick. Do you reckon that works better?
Does it? All I'm saying is, and I don't want to, you know, shit on anyone's chips here, but does it not say prick lid, prick film?
I mean, that isn't.
Do not remove.
I'll be honest, I don't think it says prick.
Oh.
Pierce film. But I don't think
maybe
that matters.
It's too many steps in the maybe. Process to buy into it.
But I reckon leaving a gap, it does get a laugh.
Well, you got 50 minutes to fill tonight, so
yeah,
throw it in.
I'm going to stick that in. Oh, yeah. And actually, I'll record it and then we'll play it back and I'll leave a gap and we'll see how
and
it goes.
What about that joke last night you messaged me and said, is this funny?
What joke last night? Oh, yes. We could talk about that quickly. Yeah. I tried it last night and it didn't work.
Oh.
Oh, no, hang on.
So I say what you said.
No.
You texted me and said.
Did it work?
You said, is this funny?
Might work. Yes. Okay, that's not the one I was thinking of.
And you said, is this funny? My porn fantasy is, don't judge me, the one where the dad has sex with the babysitter. Now, I'd never actually do it. I don't have time to be a babysitter.
Yeah. I think that will work, actually. Right. I think there will. I think it needs work.
I mean, I butchered the delivery there, I think.
Yeah. So the idea is I make everyone think I want to be the dad having sex with the babysitter. But makes everyone a bit uncomfortable, a bit of tension. Release tension. I want to be banged by the dad. That's essentially the joke. Do you think that's funny? I think that's something.
That's the 1557 from Dubai there. Coming in. I think my amendments to it were better.
Yes. Is that why you brought it up? Because you wanted to get your amendments?
Mark.
That is why you brought it up. What were your amendments?
My amendments were, wouldn't it be better if you said...
And I agreed with all the amendments.
Yeah. You said, don't judge me, but my porn fantasy is the one where dad has sex with a babysitter.
So what I said before, my porn fantasy is, and don't judge me. Because I think that is more how you would say it. Because you'd go... You start saying it, you go, but don't judge me. But I think you are right in joke writing wise. I think you should start, don't judge me, but my porn fantasy is when the dad has sex with the babysitter.
And then I said, you should say, now, I'd never actually do that. I don't have time to babysit.
Yes,
right. And you said, I don't have time to be a babysitter. No one ever said that.
And I think that's right because I would have said babysitter twice.
Yeah.
To babysit.
See, this is master, this is the senpai teaching the sensei here. You tell me about repeating words.
But or you could ask yourself, would a sensei maybe test his
so
protege.
Oh, clever.
By setting up a joke that wasn't quite right. It was to see if he picked up on it. And you passed. Here's your green belt.
Yes.
So tell you what, I was on the way back from a gig the other night. And here's the thing, Danny. You would think all the comedians on the road of a weekend, that's a lot of comedians, aren't there? From your open mics to your professional bills.
It could be 500.
You stop off at services regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely do you ever see other comedians at services. You would think that would happen a lot, wouldn't you? But anyway, I was having a wee the other day in the services, mm-hmm. and I was just leaving, and Pierre Hollins walked in, and he looked at me, and he sort of had this big reaction, like, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And then I was thinking about it, and I think I've only ever bumped into 7 comedians in the services, and I can remember them all. Do you want me to name them?
I'd love you to, but also, can you put like the Top of the Pops music over it, and then rank them in who you think's the best?
So, well, not the best. Let's do it in the order of when it happens.
Boo! That's not as fun. Rank them.
So,
who's
so
the best?
The first one, and one. Is that what they say?
No, you
no,
start
that's
seven.
Darts,
you go backwards.
At number seven, it's Ramesh Ranganathan.
Well, he should be number one.
So this is the first one. Yeah. I was having a wee, and then I literally just looked to my right, and Ramesh was having a wee. We were just weeing next to each other. Right. This was quite a while ago. And then
he has people to do that for him now.
Yeah. And then,
huh? What's that?
Number.
Oh, number six. Sorry,
number six. I bumped into, this is six and five and six, actually. I bumped into Milo McCabe and Elliot Steele.
Number four,
this is a weird one. I'd been touring with Sean Walsh for ages. He was the one person I spent the most time in services with. We had a little break from the tour, a few days. I went off to a gig towards Norwich and went to this obscure services. This was like a day after we finished the tour. Went to obscure services I'd never been to. Why would anyone go to it? It's in the middle of nowhere. And I was just in M&S, and I was walking around, and in the queue, Sean. Just
mental.
What's the chances of that? That we didn't even discuss where we were going next day. That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a coincidence.
It is. Three? Was it two?
Number three. That's fairly recent. I bumped into a comedian called James Ellis. He's sort of a newer comedian. He's very funny. Chatted to him in Acosta. And then over his shoulder, I was looking. And I saw Joey Page and Jeff Innocent walk through.
Well, that's
what's the chance of that?
Yeah. All, 4-1.
And they weren't together.
Who, Jeff and Joey?
Jeff and Joey.
Jeff and Joey,
but James Ellis wasn't with them. That was just a coincidence that we're all...
Because Jeff told me when he saw you as well, so...
Did he?
Getting that, yeah,
getting that
stereo.
Ways, yeah? What did he say? What did he say about
it? He said, I met that... Mark Simmons.
Oh, I can't say the C.
Yeah, you can just... I can show you how to download a bleep sound off the internet.
Okay, you showed me that.
Yeah.
Cool.
That's... Is that...
And
is
then
Joey and
Pierre
Jeff,
Hollins, and I'm at the end.
Is Joey and Jeff...
That was the last one.
Mark, you've left. No, it isn't. This is incredible. Mark actually can't remember another one.
Have I met you?
No, Mark.
Who else have I met?
I can't believe this is ridiculous. Do you
know Michael McIntyre.
Yeah, yeah, no shit.
Oh, yeah.
Charlie knows that.
Oh, yeah. By the way, there's someone called Charlie. We haven't established that our friend Charlie's here. Oh, yeah, yeah, Michael McIntyre as well. That was an interesting one.
Now, have you
one.
Kept him to the end because he was the last or first chronologically?
I'd forgotten.
Or was it because he's the best?
Michael McIntyre.
Richest,
I'd forgotten.
Oh, there you go.
Because
you had a conversation about him.
Because I
well.
See the others are more my friends, whereas I didn't. I'd only met Michael.
You said he was
McIntyre.
Really nice to you, and yeah, right,
yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. I doubt he'd consider himself my friend. Although the show, I did a show with him a few weeks before I saw him again, random. Only just met him, and then I bumped into him, and that was a show called Michael McIntyre and Friends, and I'd never met him before. I did it, so. Yeah, bumped into him, and I'd never seen fame like this. Like, I'm friends with comedians that are famous, but this was a different level. I stopped him to say hello to him. We started chatting, having a lovely conversation, and then he started... people just came up to him, physically tapping him on the shoulder, saying, can I have a selfie? Can we have a selfie? Like, so rude. And then this, like, this crowd formed of people, loads of people... around us, and he was like, I think you better go because I've got to deal with this, I've got to get on to this thing. And then I just left him, and he was just having to deal with all these people with photos and all that. I mean, that's a, would you want that level of fame of that? Like, that's, it's a different level. That's,
let's think about this. Would I, if you had that much money, maybe you'd have your own like camper van with a toilet on board.
I tell you, he was I don't know, he was probably in a limo or something. No, not a limo.
Do you want to hear my service station stories?
I'd love to hear your service station
so
stories.
So I bumped into two comedians. One was Mitch Benn, and that was on the there's a, you know, when you're coming from the A3, no, not the A3, it's the A303, then it becomes the M3.
Have you been past Stonehenge?
Oh yeah, wait, yeah. This
on your right, Stonehenge on your right.
Stonehenge on your left. On so your you left, go, you're coming into back. London, come back into, yeah, because right, we were turning back to a gig, coming okay. back from a gig. I was in the car with Paul F. Taylor, come up who else, and there's a little M&S there just before the little petrol station, almost like a petrol station by the services. Mm. Saw Mitch Benn there. And then another time.
Which aeroplane is that, Danny?
That one. That is the 1806 from Shanghai. And then another time I saw, God, it's gone. Bob Mills.
I saw
Bob Mills in McDonald's once.
Ah, did you?
That was on the M3. But here's the thing. We'd been at the same gig.
Ah, okay, that doesn't count.
But he does it not? No. He'd left early because I had to pack up the gear.
Right, that doesn't count.
Right, okay.
So any other service stations?
Once I was travelling to Stoke-on-Trent, I think, with Angela Barnes.
What motorway?
That would have probably been. Be the M6, wouldn't it? And we stopped at the services and went to Starbucks. And in front of us in the queue at Starbucks was Gary Lineker.
Gary goddamn Lineker.
And what was interesting about it is that I've seen Gary Lineker a couple of times here and there. And, And very, very clean shirt, very tan. Looks like, you know you're sort of looking at someone, I guess.
Like an aura about
him. Yeah, like there's a clear sort of sense of celebrity about him. And he's talking to someone at the front. With his tongue, so I'm ordering the coffee, and then as he's ordering the coffee, the woman behind the counter just turns round, and there's those are big cups on the back wall.
Yeah,
turns around, just gets a cup, gives it to him, and hands him a pen, and almost without asking, like he had no expectation of, you know, it was obvious what he was being asked to do. It must happen to him all the time. He got the pen almost without any kind of dialogue, signed this mug. She took it back off him and just put it back on the. On the wall behind him.
Said.
Yeah, almost like nothing said. Like, it's just like, oh, well, obviously.
It's quite funny, Starbucks, they're known for writing your name on the cups.
And it's just obvious, like, any time he goes to Starbucks, he's going to be asked to sign a cup and it goes behind the bar.
That just happens.
And again, it's a bit like Michael McIntyre when people bang, you know, want you a selfie. If you're Gary Lineker and you order at Starbucks, you're going to have to sign a mug.
Yeah. Did he pay for the Starbucks?
I couldn't speculate.
That's
a funny thing.
Once you get really famous, you don't pay for things anymore. Yeah. Whereas you're the one with all the money.
Well, absolutely. I know that about someone with the Audi A5. It's the fastest road car in the market, or was at one point. It's like an Audi estate.
Right.
I actually took it to be cleaned. I wasn't insured looking back on it, but I took it to a... And when I was getting it cleaned at one of those American car washes, all the blokes were like, oh, nice car, mate, nice car. You know, can you show what it can do when we pull away? And I put my foot down. You know, scared myself shitless. I won't say who that was because it's... It was Jimmy Nesbitt.
And did you?
But the point is that he got given the car by Audi. So one of the few people in the country who could afford the car got given it free anyway.
Right. Yeah. I thought you were... Yeah, because I know a well-known comedian that got a Nando's black card.
Yeah.
That he's a millionaire.
Yes.
But then he gets free chicken now as well. It's strange, isn't
it? One of those things, isn't it? Do you know what Nando's black card is, Charlie? A Nando's black card is... It might even be a myth, an urban myth. But
it's a real thing.
They do think... So basically, if you're really, really rich and successful and famous, you get a Nando's black card, which is free Nando's forever.
Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's only a certain amount of people who've got one. I think David Beckham's got one. Have I made that up?
I don't know.
We'd have to... If we were at my flat, we could ask Alexa. But... And then my last story...
Well, we've got an Alexa here. But it might just take a little bit longer. It's called a Charlie. ask for Charlie.
Just Google now.
Say it.
Hang on, maybe ask the phone.
Ask a Charlie.
Charlie, what is a Nando's black card? Who's got a Nando's black card?
Yeah.
David Beckham.
Yeah.
David Beckham has a Nando's black card.
There we go.
Do you want to hear my final story for the services?
Yes. I mean, I'm sure everybody's lapping up these
stories.
Oh,
this is a big one. This is a big one. So we're coming back from... It must have been Leeds. I've got Mark Meyer in the car.
Yep.
Mayor. And I've got Mayer in the car, and it's late night, and we're coming down the services, and we pull into these services because we need a toilet. And as we pull in, guess who's just walking through the services, use the toilet as well?
Hey.
Tom Jones.
Oh!
Tom Jones. He's got a couple of you know, a couple of psychics or security or whatever.
Tom Jones. And Mark sees
it's Tom Jones, and he's like, "Oh, that's Tom Jones." It's like, "Yeah." He's like, "Oh, I'm going to ask him for a picture." And I was like, "Oh God, okay." And so we sort of he's hanging around, waiting for Tom Jones to come out of the toilet. And when he comes out of the toilet, Mark goes, "Oh, can I have a photo, Tom?" And I'll never forget it. I saw Tom Jones look around, making this calculation in his head as to, is there enough people watching me so that I have to say yes to this?
Yeah.
And he obviously did the calculation and realised there was probably enough people that meant he couldn't just say, fuck off, mate, I'm having a piss. And he had to photo with Mark. I know, I took it. I had to take it.
Did
that
you?
Was right. I had to take the photo of it.
What aeroplane is that, Danny? It's a loud one.
I got that one. That's the 1811 from...
Wow, look, there's two so close together. Look behind you.
That's from Sydney.
What about those two?
That one.
Look how close they are.
Well, that's the... Poor old Mark. He's not lived in London long.
Look at the aeroplanes.
He's getting excited. Mate, have you ever been down to City Airport? One a minute.
Is it?
Yeah.
Wow.
That is the delayed. That's a 1564.
They're a bit close together for my liking.
Yeah, we could be having a near miss here. So I was just watching Tom Jones doing his calculation. Like, yeah, I'm going to have to get this photo. But it's funny to stop a 70-year-old bloke at midnight on his way out of a urinal, isn't it?
Yeah, for
a photograph.
I suppose for him it's not unusual.
Hey, we can't top that. Call it a day, mate.
We have got a cracking episode for you today. I'm over the moon that we've got this gentleman on. I'm a big fan of his. We've only got Miles Jupp, Danny.
Yeah.
It's a corker. It's an absolute corker. I'm chuffed that he did it.
Been in my favourite. No, I haven't. Actually, maybe years and years and years ago, but he's in my favourite sitcom of all time.
The Thick of It.
The Thick of It.
Yeah. It's Miles Jupp. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Humiliated me once. I did this show with Simon Munnery where we toured around Scotland acting Johnson and Boswell.
Oh yeah.
And there would be this thing where we were recreating with the help of the audience a crossing to the Isle of Skye that in Boswell's book is madness, whereas in
I've been there.
Crossing was a bit choppy. And so I get the audience, we've got all these buckets and they've got all these sort of bits of flotsam in and plastic fish and stuff. And I go through this whole thing where I'm going to, when I point at you, throw them. And I learn this long thing and the lights are flashing. I'm on a table pretending it's like a ship in a sailing thing. And I'm doing this long bit from the diary, which is just taking me ages to learn. And I would point at them and they'd throw the contents of the buckets. And there was one place. Now, where was it? Oh, damn it. It's a place that's got a sort of amusingly catchy slogan. Anyway, wherever this place was, I then forgot to say the contents of the buckets. I said, throw the bucket. And so during that thing, and I couldn't stop it once it was up and running. So I wish I could name the name of the place. It's small theatre. But anyway, I did. So I went through this thing, and every time I pointed, they would throw not the contents, but the actual bucket. So for this 5-minute routine with the lights flashing, me doing loads of dialogue, every time I pointed at someone, they threw a full bucket, which hit me. About well over half of them hit me. And then for the next 10 or whatever things of the show, I'd say, now remember to throw the contents of the buckets, not the buckets themselves, as they did in such and such. And the idea of it being this place where they'd misunderstood the instructions or whatever seemed funny. Yeah. So that line stayed in. Mm. And then for some reason, on the last night, we were in Kilmarnock. And I forgot, as I've done now, but I had less excuse then. I forgot that I didn't say the name of the place. I said, not the buckets themselves, like they did in Kilmarnock, I said, but in Kilmarnock. And there was a thought, have you been pretending that... Are we the place that you've been abusing all this time, pretending that we've been doing that? Just absolutely baffling. And it was just... No. They must have thought, you cheeky bugger, you've been going around pretending that we've got this wrong and we're about to get it right, you arse. Yeah, that kind of thing. You've got... You can just... That thing of turning off on stage once. I remember doing that Reading University gig once, and I, for whatever reason, I must have been gigging so much at the time that you get slightly on autopilot. And I sort of half woke up and thought, oh gosh, this isn't going terribly well. They've just drifted off. Well, they've drifted off, I thought. So then I sort of put some effort in, and you know, it all came back again. But there wasn't, and I just suddenly thought, oh God. And I hadn't really, I dozed quite off. Anyway, sorry, we're probably way off topic.
Are you Are you planning on doing stand up again, or how do you do it? Do you just go, I'm going to do a tour, I think, and then start back?
Yeah,
at it?
So I have started writing a show actually.
Oh, cool.
I don't know if I'll do it or not, and I don't know how it ends. But because the story I'm telling in this show, I'm still sort of living a bit. It's not rather than going, oh, I can't think of an ending.
So you won't have tried any of what you've written out yet. You'll write a big chunk of stuff. And then...
No, I do a completely terrifying thing, which is, again, it's partly because I don't, you know, if I lived in London, I could get on get in the Overground, just go and say, I'll go and do 10 minutes every night once everyone's gone to bed or whatever. But I can't sort of do that so much. So actually what I end up doing is sitting down and coming up with like 20,000 words of stuff and put it in an order. So James Kettle has directed the last couple of shows and like, you know, put it all in the right order and stuff. And I suppose there's a kind of script editing aspect of that as well. And I would go down, plus he writes amusing jokes. And then I would go down and just do like 2 hours, bang.
What?
Off a lectern pretty much. And just do all of it in a wonner, which is obviously an awful evening for me in terms of nerves. But actually, it's really enjoyable.
Yeah.
You're just getting all of this out for the first time, and then maybe do that 2 or 3 more times and listen to it back. So I'll kind of do the thing as a whole.
Yeah.
And then maybe have a warm-up, go to like somewhere and just like for 3 nights and just do full-length shows.
I mean, have you ever...
I know that sounds crazy.
But
then for me, there's a sort of theatre to it. So it's a bit like writing and learning and rehearsing a play, really. Then it can get to the point where you can be freer. But I need to do that bit first rather than some people's. It starts loose and then tightens into a thing. Whereas I like to start with a tight thing and that's the thing that changes. And then a month into a tour, you suddenly come up with the ideal closer for a bit that you haven't. Or whatever, but I need to do the solid bit. In cricketing terms, that's my solid defensive technique.
Yeah.
When that's absolutely in order, I'll play a few shots maybe.
Yeah. Wow.
But
so
yeah, it is.
So I guess...
It is the probably the wrong way around to do it, and quite terrifying. But it's just the way that developed for me. It's practical. Yeah.
I guess the fear is none of it works. I guess that's the initial. That's a lot of an hour in, and you're like, I've wasted quite a lot of time writing this.
There's thousands of words I've read down. Yes, that would be the fear. I suppose the thing is, like you were saying, if you're doing it in front of a big room, if you're touring, people are coming in a way to see the sort of thing that you do.
Yeah,
I mean, I had to be talked out of calling a tour show more of the same. But I kind
that's
of thought
great.
That is what it is.
I like it.
You know, or so a title like me talking about the sort of things you'd imagine I'd talk about. You know, what people know you are maybe, and they like this, and some of them will like the sort of thing that you do, so they want to come and see you do an example of that sort of thing that you do. And then if you do enough of that, then you can sort of do some prizes or whatever. I had one tour show that I had a like load of politics in the second half that was, you know, that I'd sort of earned the right to. To do, I guess, by doing the sort of thing they'd expect me to do for the majority of it. And then I got a news quiz and it seemed like, oh God, I don't want to go out and do political stuff when doing stand-up.
But then they probably want that. If they're a fan of you from the news quiz, maybe that's what they like.
Yeah, I suppose there you're like so tuned into the news that you think, oh, there is a topical aspect of... that you can add on to every sort of existing stuff and whatever, and you're like, oh, like Michael Gove is the bauble that I can hang on this particular bit here. I mean, it was completely mad at me, not as mad as Michael Gove, obviously, but those kind of. But there, it's a little bit painted by numbers, and you sort of hate yourself for doing it. So partly, you think, no, fuck it, I've written this show. That's what I'm going to do. And
but
they're actually desperate for me to talk about the European referendum, as I seem to have been doing for. 60 episodes, then they'll have to bloody
listen to the radio. But I guess if you're running your show past your director first as well, that's also a nice kind of, there must be something, you're not going on completely cold, you know?
Well, there is that element of it, but also I wouldn't get in touch with someone else until I'd really written 19,000-20,000 words or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
So at that moment, you really are on your own going, well, I hope this works.
Yeah. Are you excited about what you've written so far?
I think so, yeah. It's like a story.
Is that unusual for you to do a story for a
I've
full show?
I've done one before. I did a show in 2010 called Fibber and the Heat, which was a story. And I guess I like this one. I can't work out whether to have like the story as the spine and then go off at different tangents, because I've got some tangential stuff. Or you go, oh no, write a club set basically and then do the show or whatever. I really like, I watch very little stand-up these days, but what I used to do when preparing for stories, I'd watch the beginning of them. Because you think, what do people come out and do? It, almost like by the time they start speaking, you're like, no, that's irrelevant now. What's the thing, the empty stage, or is there a set, or is it loud music, or is it relaxed and whatever? And that's the sort of bit. So like on Netflix, you've like started, you know, the tiny little red line underneath these presumably brilliant shows. But you're like, I don't need to see that bit. I just want to see the bit when they get to the microphone or whatever. But I have watched Mike Birbiglia, about three or four of his specials. Mm. And I kind of thought, I'd like to achieve that kind of vibe. Am I using the word vibe correctly? The sort of atmosphere that he creates.
Yeah.
Kind of think, oh, it'd be quite nice to have a show that was halfway between the one I've done that was sort of pure storytelling and the other ones that have been just bits of stuff.
Yeah.
I really like his kind of low key.
Yes, I listened. I fairly recently watched his stuff, but I think I listened to it on Spotify. I think he's got.
And I suppose that what I hope I would have in common is the sort of part of the delivery is like, look, I've written the stuff, here it is.
Mm.
So everyone, look, we've all got a part to play in this. Mine is doing the thing. I've done the work already. I'm now going to present it to you. And you please, you know, you've bought a ticket and you're hopefully sitting comfortably and, you know, join the dots.
Lovely. So have you got any bits that over the years that you sort of written? So what's your hit rate like? So if you've written a show like that, will you be ditching quite a lot of the stuff? Or
yeah, I reckon you would just, and also because in fact James Kettle said I can't remember his excellent phrase for it, but it was pointing out, you know, you put it all on the page and then sort of take it off again. So the first get it all down, that thing, get it done and then get it right kind of attitude. You know, I would have like written a story and I'd be saying, now bear in mind this shop, it's probably only 6 or 7 minutes walk from my front door. So that sentence goes.
I need that, yeah.
There's a shop near me. You know, that's all it is. So there'd be a lot of sort of exposition that one would be hacking away.
Frank Skinner in his book says about, he says it as it's a block of ice, straight, like everything is a block of ice, and then he just chips away and sculpt, and that makes the sculpture. That's how sort of the first person I heard talk about how to put it together like that. So get it all down.
What I do is I make an enormous pile of clay. So he starts with the ice, whereas I start with nothing, make an enormous amount of clay, and it's quite hard to do this, attempt to chisel the clay, even though it's a very sort of, it breaks very easily. It's very, very sort of fractious sort of material. But yeah, there is an element, but I kind of really, and it's an odd thing that, is it the phrase kill your darlings? Is that what people say about sort of writing? I kind of like the idea that you've done a load of work and then you can then go through it. It's the same with some of the books I've written. You go through and you're like, oh, I can put a red line through this whole page. And actually that feels luxurious rather than going, no, I kind of think, yeah, great. Well, I can do that. I've done lots of this stuff now. I want it to be 80,000 words. It's currently 120. So great. I can put that through the whole thing. And I kind of don't mind that. And I used to say in the writer's room for the news quiz, these are the jokes I like. Let's either make them shorter or make them longer and more florid. Maybe change some of the references. And some of them will go, let's get to the point quicker. Some of them, they need a slight tweak. Some of them, let's go fucking bananas with this one and see if it can build into some ludicrous thing. There was one, maybe the earlier seasons, where it just went off on some slight sort of, you know, oh, this is all just everything that's wrong with everything and blah, 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 blah. And we all just need to go back to the trees from whence we came was where this thing. And I don't even know what it started out as a joke about. But every now and then you take something small and make it really big and sort of balustrade and otherwise just sort of pare it down. So I couldn't really tell you what the hit rate is other than the fact that you might. I used to think an Edinburgh show was 9,000 words. Does that sound right to you?
You're the only person I've ever spoke to that says it in how many words, like a word count, like an essay. No one's
because ever... it is a is a piece of writing. I guess when I started doing Edinburgh shows, I was still at university.
Yeah, so it's fascinating.
So I used to think that seems to be about, so if I've got 12,000, like, great, well, I can lose a third of that, or I can lose a quarter of it, or whatever. Because I suppose I must, I don't know, maybe I just sort of speak at one pace. I mean, occasionally I get excited, but...
But you might be right. It might just be that's the way you were thinking when you started stand-up, and it, you just, it's just stayed with you.
I suppose now I would, you go out there and you do, oh, how long was that, would be one of the questions I'd ask for a first thing. Well, yeah, that was 9 hours. Oh, right. Yes.
That's why
that's too long. Is it too long, or do we just need an interval? You know, what's it?
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So have you got any bits that over the years that you've liked and couldn't get to work for that
I've got
you?
Bits that I didn't like that I kept on doing because I just didn't have anything else. So when I started, I started at the Stand in Edinburgh, and I put together, I had a 20 quite quickly, and the beginning worked and the middle worked and the end worked, but between the middle and the end there was a sort of repository where I was like, I know I have to do 20.
yeah.
And I remember having this thing that really didn't, I was able to dress, it was quite at odds with everything else I was doing. So at the time I would literally be wearing corduroys and a tweed jacket and stuff like that. But I had this sort of silly bit of wordplay.
About banging chicks.
It was all about like the East Coast, West Coast hip hop rivalries. And how it was all moot anyway, because I was all about Detroit. No, it was all. I should have. That's what it should have been. It was this ludicrous thing where there was a park near me on the meadows, and there was a playground, and it said there was a sign on the gate that said no dogs, no cycling, no ball games. And so I had this silly thing about like walking past it and seeing this sign: no dogs, no ball games, no cycling. And then looking over the railing, and I saw a dog on a unicycle bouncing a beach ball on its head. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that is just a blatant breach of the rules, quite frankly. And I was shouting at this dog, and a lady came over. She said, "That dog's very clever, actually." I said, "Well, it obviously can't read, you know." And it sort of works as a thing, but it was so kind of out of context. And you'd think, like, I would gig there so often that you could almost tell how a gig was going by looking at the eyes of the bar staff at the back. And that was the one where you think they'd be like, why does he keep doing this bit? It's got nothing to do with anything. But until I came up with some new stuff, I had to sort of do that. And in the end, I did find a way of making it sort of more ornate or whatever. I realised it was actually, that playground was on the front cover. It was a black and white photo. It was on the front cover of an Ian Rankin novel. So I'd say, I don't even know the playground. It's one on that one, I suppose. If you're sort of aspiring middle class, you probably want to start reading some Ian Rankin or whatever.
Right.
I'd say. But that sort of never really worked, but I had to keep on doing it.
And that's funny, because in the hands of someone else, that would be a really good bit. I mean, you just telling me that then made me laugh as a set piece. Because the line of, he can't read, is so good.
Oh, right. I thought it was, that's very nice of you. Maybe I could, yeah.
But well, the thing is, the trouble is, I think people, when they watch you,
it's unexpectedly surreal.
Yes, because it's just, is that what it is? There's no realism in the setup. So people like, they're a little bit like, oh, what?
Because I do it off the back of a real sort of story that was about a slight sort of tiff in a flat share argument or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I go, and I was so cross. So I went out for a walk and I was walking along. And it was so sort of unpleasantly shoehorned that I think people found it upsetting. I had a joke as well that I like, again, that was not my sort of joke, but I really liked, and I lost my nerve with it. The joke was, it was sort of about manners, and I was going to go, I suppose, a bit like saying, it's rude to talk with your mouth full, I suppose, the equivalent. So I was going, apparently it's very rude to do sign language with your hands full. And I sort of came up with this, and then I didn't know, I'd gone to New Zealand. I was doing a show in New Zealand that was a sort of an hour-long stand-up show that I suppose was various other ones put together. And I knew exactly what I was going to do with that. I'd got it sort of nailed down. I'd done a few tryouts before I went out there. Cause it's quite terrifying getting to the other side of the world. And you think, I remember when I first started, I started out in Edinburgh. I went down and did that Leicester Mercury Comedian of the Year thing. And I remember sitting on the phone going, I don't know if this is funny in England. I've only done this in Scotland. I don't even know if this is, will this be funny in Leicester? I've got no idea. So then going to the other side of the world to do stuff. And then I had my opening night at the San Francisco Bathhouse in Wellington. It was just so near the top of my mind that I literally walked out, and that was the first thing I said to the audience out of nowhere. I haven't given them any chance to tune in to what I had. And of course, there was a sort of like, hello there. Apparently, it's very rude to do, that sort of, when you've been like, hello, nice to be. Before in their head, some of them probably will have thought, that's the way he pronounces hello, it's nice to be here. It came sort of so out. And then I sort of lost confidence with it.
Because I don't think it's not a bad thing to start with. Because with your persona, you could go into that with sort of about talking about manners. That seems quite a real. This is how I talk.
And I guess the way to go with it would be to be really rude to see. I went to a BSL course and the teacher was signing with his hands full, and I just thought this is completely disrespectful. I suppose you try and have a sort of bit of attitude.
Yeah.
About it. Jared Christmas was there, and I was going, I'm sure that's a good. He was like, no, it is good, but I don't know why it wouldn't.
Do you think, because as a comic, I would prefer, personally, I prefer it if you didn't mention the mouthful thing first. So then you
I didn't mention the mouthful thing first. I literally just said, apparently it's very rude to do sign language.
Because I like that you have to do the work.
But want people to have tuned in a bit beforehand.
Yeah,
I guess.
I don't think. I think regular audiences won't make the jump unless you've done a lot of stuff already like that.
I think there's that thing, those jokes that people sort of set up who they are. I remember doing a gig in, Ian Smith.
Mm, yeah.
He used to run a gig in Howden, like that. I must have done 13, 14 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember getting off the train wherever it was we get off the train there to go and do it, and there was I thought the guy who runs the gigs brought his son with him, and then the son was like, hello, I'm Ian, this is my gig, right? And he was great, and we were on with Paul Foote. If he still does this, I apologize, Paul. I thought it was so funny. He had this thing, and he comes out, obviously he's a slightly sort of distinctive look, and he said, when I was little what would be the sort of bird you'd have as a pet? A budgie. Yeah. I had a budgie and it died. And my parents thought they could trick me. So they got another budgie and replaced my dead budgie with a new budgie. But I knew it was a different budgie and I killed that one too.
I love that joke.
It's such a brilliant joke. Does he still do that joke?
No, I think Paul's one person that doesn't ever do anything again. It was so
brilliant, but also so set up. It was also saying, this is the world that you are now entering.
Yes, yeah.
And that's kind of, I suppose that's your thing, because I suppose some comedy, stand-up comedy, is coming out to the audience and saying, I'm just like you. It's us against them.
Mm.
And there's some people coming out and they're saying, I'm not like you.
Yeah.
Or some people are saying, I am like you and we're marvellous and everyone else is an idiot. kind of thing. I'm not naming any names here, but we all know. and that's the kind of, you know, whereas that's saying, you know, this is a different view, and I'm and I kind of, there is that, it would be lovely to be able to walk out and go, I'm just like you, but I don't, you know, I don't sort of, like lots of people, lots of comics, I suppose, I always felt, you know, you always feel like you're slightly sort of outside looking in, even when you're in an environment when everyone is exactly like you. somewhat tragically. And that sort of thing, I can't quite, you know, that. So that sort of conspiratorial, eh? It's just us, eh? We know what's going on. I would never be able to sort of pull that off, really. It used to be a thing where, like, when going up for acting jobs in my 20s, you know, of which I got about two, the absolute dread for me would be reading the script in the audition, and it would say something like, a completely normal 27-year-old walks into the room, and I think, oh God, well, I don't have a, this is going to be a disaster. Oh no,
you walk in with this weird limp because you're just overthinking it.
I'm just going, what's normal? I'll put on, I remember once, it was the very, maybe not the first time, second time, I'm very good friends with Alex McQueen. But I met him once in an audition scenario. It's a film he did. I think he actually went on and won a BAFTA for it. But I was auditioning inexplicably as a sort of geezer. and I just didn't know. I think I might even have put like a medallion on or something. Because I thought,
I would love to see that tape.
Yeah, God. Well, it must be out there somewhere. What, in there somewhere. But yeah, you know, like, because I just couldn't.
But I think
also sometimes you get a thing and you say, I know how to do this, and other times I don't know how to do this, and it's that's sort of how it goes.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, I can't do this, but I've got to, because I've got to try. You know, in the old days when you were gigging all the time, you know, someone say, right, can you do this gig? And you think, that sounds really hard. Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I'm doing it because it sounds hard. It's like, well, I'm not doing anything else that night, and you know,
it's all part of it.
And I need to go.
Yeah,
you wouldn't just go, yeah, hello, Richard. Yeah. Oh yes. Oh, that sounds easy. Yes, all right. Yeah.
Yeah, man. You never do anything.
You're like, oh no, because that the thing is, actually, yesterday I went half as far for twice that money, so that would be inconceivable. You're like, no, okay, that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
You know, and you just keep doing it, and you would write it in the diary and thinking, well, that would be a nightmare. and it's not a self-fulfilling prophecy, it's just awareness.
Yeah.
I remember turning up the Northampton Picture Dome, and a friend of mine from school was there, and I who used to put that off the curb maybe, and I just stood at the back and I said to him, yeah, I'm afraid this isn't going to go very well. And he went, really? And I went, yeah, it's still not going to go very well. And I didn't, it wasn't like, and then in my head I was like, oh no, it's something. I just thought, yeah, it's just going to be, you know, as it,
yeah, yeah.
Because actually it would have been like the eighth night in a row I'd gigged or whatever. And by then you're kind of, you can sort of sniff the air like a farmer, can't you?
Yeah. It's always nice when the promoter says to you, this isn't going to go well. That's the best.
Has that ever happened to you?
Yeah. There's been a few where they've gone, these never go well. So, and then you just totally relax. There's no pressure.
That's quite odd, isn't it? There's somewhere I went to, I feel like it was Bergen. Is that, where is that? Scandinavia somewhere. Right. I went with Hal Cruttendon and Tim Clark. And you go and do the main point of it is a sort of nice gig in a room in a hotel in the centre of town. But before that, you go to a naval base and do an hour-long gig in a canteen.
Oh.
To silence, to complete silence, to sort of 16 and 17-year-old conscripts. And I said off, and Tim just said on the way, oh yeah, we'll get nothing here, by the way. But they do enjoy it. They like it. They want to keep doing it. So we're going to do it.
Yeah.
So you just go and do it. Mm. And you've been told that's what will happen, and you just don't panic about it.
Yeah, so much better. Well,
that's fine.
Yeah. You know. So when that joke, the hands full one, and then when that didn't work, so do you find that if it doesn't work straight off the bat, you lose confidence? Because that is a good idea.
I think just because at the time I was doing what was, I suppose, for want of a better phrase, a kind of best of thing. I was like, I'd have done four solo shows by then. So you're like, what's the hour of that works? I best do tried and tested things. But also, while I was doing that show in New Zealand, I started writing the Fibber in the Heat, which is the story telling one, and obviously there's no space for it in something like that. And then, you know, whatever, life takes over and you think, oh, that's done. There's other things where I've done a more, the last tour I did, which I think now is 2017, the sort of final, the sort of last routine was about, and I used to have a restaurant column in the Evening Standard, and one night I just had this sort of disaster where there wasn't a you couldn't book a table, and you just, that was their thing. And so we ended up, the guy I'd gone with, my friend David, we ended up waiting downstairs. They said, we'll ring you when there's a table. And by the time we got up there, we were absolutely wrecked. And I just sat down to write the review the next morning, and I couldn't remember, just couldn't remember it at all. And I went through the receipt, and I was like, I couldn't remember. And I rang Dave, and he was like, no, not really. And then I had to write, and I wrote this review, and they were like, no, you can't do this. And that became a sort of quite big set piece,
right,
a story. But yeah, actually, that had originally been sort of in the middle of the first half. And what I'd written, thinking this is a giant set piece, was quite mistakenly. And not only had I written it, but I had learnt in it, and it was very wordy, and that was the point of it. It was actually basically a very, very florid piece of writing about having a difficult poo. And I kind of thought that's the joke. It's sort of kind of using almost operatic language.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, talking about sort of symphonies and turns of phrase and going into it and sort of an allegro phase in the piece or whatever. And I tried, and I just thrown everything at it and tried to take this kind of quite sort of base idea and turn it into something,
yeah,
really big and fancy. But I suppose in the mix, there must have just been some moments of sort of quite blunt and brutal. And this thing must have been about 12 minutes long.
12 inches.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's that sort of stuff that comes in. And it was so wordy. And I did it, I think, once at the Invisible Dot. Is that called something else now?
I'm not sure what it's called now, but yeah, I know where you're talking about.
Very groovy place in King's Cross. I say groovy, it was sort of Factory Records meets the Cambridge Footlights. That was its kind of vibe. Yeah, yeah. And then, but it was very, very good place to do. And I did it there. And I booked 3-night run in an art centre in Wiltshire, maybe. And I did it for 2 of those nights. And at the end, I just thought, what am I doing? I've done it. I've done it justice. I've learnt the bloody thing.
Yeah.
But I've done it justice. And I've tried it 3 times in 2 wildly different places. And they've just gone, fucking hell, you know, what are you doing?
So no laughs throughout the whole bit?
No, it wouldn't have been no laughs, or you would just stop, I think.
Right. But
not one of those.
But not enough.
Almost no gladiatorial spirit whatsoever.
Yeah.
But
no payoff.
Afterwards, I'm thinking, that's just not an ending to a show, is it? That's a kind of
breakdown.
Graphic oversharing. Yeah. And then I was like... And then the next night when I went to the radio, I thought, no, I'm just going to move that to the end, and that is it. And I had already, you know, Wrigglesworth, I'd do a bit of additional material on his radio series. And he's like a brilliant sort of structuralist, I think.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at a way to finish the show, he's always like, it's in there. It's already in there.
Mm.
Just go back and find it.
Wow.
And then I had a big set piece at the end of another tour show, and I was like, I don't know where, and he's like, it'll be in there. Just go back through it, the line. And eventually it was a callback to a...
You found it, yeah.
...routine 20 minutes earlier or whatever. But that was a thing that was really... took a lot of effort in the writing.
That's going to be so annoying.
And in the learning. And it just...
Because at least with a one-liner, that's only 10 seconds I've wasted of my time. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't take me long to learn it. But yeah, I can imagine if you've done a full...
Well, I suppose the payback for that is those things that you say without really thinking, and they go bananas, and you're like, oh, I've...
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, great. Well, what was that? Right, that stays in, like an ad-lib, and you like, you write for 5 weeks, and you get so-and-so, and then you... You're basically breathing out, and something comes along. And so that's... You think, well, as long as I get a few of those along the way, then I don't mind kind of wearing that one.
Yeah, yeah.
And that I suppose, is... you know, that's chipping away at the ice.
Mm. Have you got any other little bits that you've, over the years, you've got down that you
just didn't? I mean, there must have. I remember once, like when you're younger, you know, and you're gigging quite a lot, and people are like, oh, because the great thing about doing this as a profession is, you know, there's the sort of freedom to go out there and do stuff. Morning, Mr. Magpie. Morning, Mr. Magpie. Morning, Mr. Magpie. I could just see a magpie on the tree, on the catalpa tree out the window. You know, and so, like, you'd be in the shower and you'd think up 5 minutes of stuff and go out and do all of it.
Mm.
And, of course, it's like you're doing that in the midst of, like, 15 minutes of stuff that you really know. And, of course, it doesn't...
Yeah, yeah.
And But I remember doing that in Glasgow in the Stand once and kind of going, oh, God, that went... But I said, I thought of all of that today and I've kind of done it all. That was really silly. And Frankie was complaining. He was going, no, there's two... That one and that one. They're really good, and you could keep doing them.
Yep, yep, yep.
Whereas I'd sort of discarded the whole thing as if it was all tainted by, oh, I'd cook them all in the same dish, so they're all fucked.
No.
It all tastes of onions. Can't do it now. But it wasn't that. I mean, there must be any number of things I've thought of that simply haven't worked. But I think there's also that they creep in and they creep out, and you kind of forget them, don't you? I mean, I'll have a laptop full of them somewhere. But also, I suppose when I started... What I did was quite sort of character driven rather than persona, and it was sort of quite brutal. I recorded Fibber in the Heat for Go Faster Stripe, and I really enjoyed it. I thought, oh, I'll go back and do my other earlier ones. And I was on the train with the laptop, and I brought them up, and I thought, oh, I wouldn't fancy doing that at all now.
Oh, really?
It was just sort of kind of so, you know.
Do you think you've like got
hectoring?
Yeah, so you've developed and you just doesn't suit what you do.
Well,
now.
I'd become sort of closer to me, whereas at first it was a sort of very snobby persona, but not in a kind of like not really too keen on PVC windows. It was more a kind of like, oh, I live in a castle and you don't, or sort of kind of sledgehammer aspect to it.
Yeah.
And I just didn't like it. But, you know, it still works at corporates.
Yes. Oh, so do you pull that stuff out for corporates? Because
no, there's only like one or two maybe that would do it. But I just didn't.
Because I guess when you're playing to your own audience, you being you is the best possible thing you could be, because they've got to know you so well now over the years.
Yeah, there's an element of that. Whereas when in front of people that don't know who, they're not there because you're there. They're there because they're a dentist.
Yeah.
So you just need things that cope. I did remember. So I used to do this thing, as I say, it was quite sort of snobby, and it was really pastiching that kind of world. And when I started it, you know, and I'd be doing this in clubs in Edinburgh and Glasgow and in pubs and stuff like that.
Mm.
My feeling was if I said something snobby, I must have said this before in other similar things, but you know, if I said something that was a snobby remark, to me, it seemed obvious that the idiot in this joke was me.
Yes, yeah.
But then actually, culturally, things sort of changed a bit. This would be sort of beginning of the noughties. And then you'd get to a point where, like, say, Jonathan Ross or someone might talk about chavs in his monologue. And people would just sort of enjoy it at face value, I guess. You know, and he can really deliver a monologue, can't he?
Yeah.
Jonathan Ross. And so then you'd be like, oh, no, but that's not the point of this. This is saying that's not, you know, we're coming at it from, you know. And so that I would feel sort of slightly discomforted by. And then you think, hang on a minute, what am I doing? Going, oh, God, I don't want people to enjoy this at face value. And you're like, but then also, why are you doing it then?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I sort of kind of went away and rethought things. So I stopped for ages, and then I started again in 2007. And the first thing I sort of wanted to do was something that was a bit more kind of story-ish.
Mm.
I'd gone to the Ballon Banana with my friend Vladimir McTavish was doing Paul Sneddon, but Vladimir McTavish is his stand-up name, and he was staying with us, and I'd gone to watch him at the Banana, and Mickey Flanagan came on at 10 to 11 and told stories for half an hour, and I thought, bloody hell, that's amazing.
Mm.
I'd love to try and do something that's a bit more different, and what he's doing there is just really being him.
Yeah.
I know that's obviously you just turn the dials up.
Yeah.
But it made me think, God, there's so many different ways to do this. Why have I got this really tatty bit of paper which has got 20 words on that is my set list, and I go and do it. And you can be sort of inventive and have fun. Or, you know, there's so many different ways of doing this. And that's actually, you know, you spend that time on the comedy circuit. Now there's people you meet in so many different fields that are like, or they're an actor now, but you met them on the comedy circuit, or they're a producer, or they're a script editor, or they just write, or they you know, they're very sort of focused, and you think, oh, it's a way of getting to lots of different things.
Yeah.
And in and of its own sake, it's this kind of great thing. I mean, you seem to be someone, you love it, don't you?
Yeah. It's just,
I can see you, just even watching like the little clip, you're like, you're just thrilled to be there and doing it.
I genuinely love
You've
doing
just,
it.
You've like, just got the toy out of the box and the instructions are simple.
See, for me, all those other things, like doing TV, all that stuff, is all it's the opposite of what you just said. They're all stepping stones so that I can do this to lots of people on tour.
Yeah.
That's sort of my end goal.
I think that's the right way round. I mean, I did a tour show in, I think it was 2014, and I'd done the circuit for a few years by then, and I'd done 4 Edinburgh shows and whatever, and then it was only then, and I think I'd done, you know, I did the first series of Rev, and only then did I actually start getting asked on sort of panel shows and stuff, and then I ended up doing quite a lot of them, and then I suddenly thought, oh, hang on a minute, but I'm not doing the thing. I'm literally just turning up and doing these.
Yeah,
but I'm not doing. Everyone else is here because they do lots of stuff. Mm. And I kind of thought, they do lots of live comedy, and I've got to a point where I'm not.
That's interesting, yeah.
I'm so not you're... doing these. So then I went back to it thinking, hang on a minute, I should go back and do the thing.
Yeah.
The thing that really sort of got you there. It might be that like a little bit of profile is nudge or something else, but you think, really, I'm sat behind a desk making sort of silly remarks because I also used to stand up with a microphone in my hand doing those things. And so that sort of motivated me to write a show and go out and talk, because I thought I need to do the proper bit as well.
Yeah.
Not just take the kind of little, you know, glacé cherries. You know.
It's like a muscle, isn't it? If you work the muscle on tour, when you go into those other environments, you'll just be super sharp, right?
Well, having a show in you, I think, is a sort of great feeling. And it's quite weird to suddenly realize, oh, I've got the thing now. I've got it. It's there. It's in. When you go through there, and it's all just notes on bits of scraps of paper or whatever. And I used to think when I did, in those times when I did do the circuit, and would, you know, you'd sort of gig quite hard, you'd have a lot of stuff in there, and it meant that you could, you know, you really could sort of work the room in a kind of, right, what weeknight is it? What do they? I remember going out somewhere, like a club in Southampton somewhere, and going out and doing what I was normally doing at the time, and after about 4 or 5 minutes, I thought, I'm not really going for this. And I knew I had to do 45 minutes. And I thought, that's all right, I'll do something different then. And I just had that in the locker, which, I wouldn't have now.
Yeah.
But at the time, I was like, okay, if they don't like that sort of thing, I'll do something else for the other 40 minutes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And thinking, you know, or you'd do a set that you could do Monday to Thursday. Or sometimes you turn up on Thursday and you go, oh, I think I need to do the sort of weekendy set here. And then you go somewhere on a Sunday and you're like, you do a completely different, like if you're closing, for whatever reason, Sundays you'd have sort of longer closing sets or whatever. And you would do 45, 50 minutes that you wouldn't have done the night before, wherever you'd been the night before or whatever. And that kind of match fitness is a nice
like, do you remember?
And one I don't expect to get back.
No. But do you remember all your old stuff that could, like, if something happened in the room, could you go into an old bit, or do you just?
I think it would almost like it would just have to. You'd have to rely on your muscle memory, wouldn't you? It might happen, and it would be there, but it's not. I wouldn't. I go. Oh, well, that show was about. No, I can't. I've got sitting on the back in the laundry room or whatever, the old sort of set list from a show I did before we moved here, and I look at those words now and think,
what does that mean?
What is that? I suppose some of it I remember maybe because it was then on the McIntyre's Roadshow set or the Apollo set, and they're kind of slightly nearer to the surface, or people might say, oh, you do that thing about Wheaties
smarting,
and you're like, yes.
Because people see that all the time because they go on YouTube and that's
those sort of things. So they're all sort of reminded of those. Whereas other things, you think, I must have performed if I've done 6 Edinburgh shows plus 2 tours. That's 3 tours, but only one of them was Edinburgh. You're like, there's like 11 hours of stuff that I must have done, and I can't imagine what nearly all of it must have been.
There's a bit you did on Apollo about Boris, blaming Boris Johnson for everything. That bit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, that's not aged well, has it? No, that's very
good. I was going to say, because was that when he was mayor of London?
Must have been, yeah.
Right. I was going to say.
So that would have been a sort of very kind of London-centric piece of material, I suppose, at the time.
Yeah, it was great. And I was wondering if you would have carried on doing it when he sort of changed his job roles, or whether it changed the bit.
Yeah, probably. If by the time he was, I wasn't really gigging by the time he, or was he? Oh, I can't exactly remember the timeline.
Because it still, in theory, works, but I didn't know what difference it would have made.
Do you know what? I reckon I'd have done that bit at the Hardy thing. Was it about him looking, when he wakes up?
Yeah, he looks...
He looks like a man that's just come around from general anaesthetic.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I must have done that for what I sort of did dust that off recently. But also, when I was doing the Apollo thing, I thought I needed, for Jeremy, I thought I need to do stuff that I know.
Yeah, because I was wondering now that he's Prime Minister and there's so much more happened, like whether that works better now as a bit, now that everybody knows.
I reckon everything I've written will be absolute gold now. It just needed to mature. Do you know what I mean? It was a bit, you know, just to ripen. No, that probably would work better now. Whereas at the time, we'd be like, oh, that's quite quirky, having such a long bit about what would you have been then? Home mayor or home secretary or foreign secretary or whatever.
Imagine having
4 minutes on the foreign secretary or whatever. Whereas now, you'd be like, it's a bit odd that he hasn't have got 4 minutes on the prime minister.
Yeah. Brilliant. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do Mauser Joppa. Yes, sir. What an episode. Great stuff. Thanks so much to Miles for coming into the joke studio. It was on Zoom.
And we're not even in the studio anyway.
We haven't got a studio. Don't tell anyone that. Brilliant. Any feedback, let us know at Jokes with Mark. That is not the end of the episode. If you would like to listen to the rest of it, head over to patreon.com/jokeswithmark. So, Danny,
mm-hmm.
Anything more from you?
Nothing more from me, Mark. Anything more from you, Mark?
Nothing more from me, Danny. Hashtag Ooga, everybody.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.